This episode of The Candid Frame is brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club. Their carefully curated selections reflects the best in contemporary photography, and all for a reasonable price. And they are delivered directly to your doorstep each month. They offer free shipping to the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. It's subsidized elsewhere. It's a great way to begin or expand your photo library. Join the club at charcoalbookclub.com today. And remember to use the promo code THECANDIDFRAME at checkout. I know a few people for whom fashion is an art. I don't mean that they make or design clothes. These folks use fashion as a form of self-expression, an art unto itself. Their clothing choices have nothing to do with brand names or fashion trends. They choose colors, fabrics, and styles to express something about themselves and describe how they navigate the world. Now, when you hear the name Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the vision of a fashionista likely doesn't come to mind. She served as an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court from 1993 until she died in 2020. In addition to sitting on the bench for many landmark legal cases, she advocated for gender equality and women's rights. Yet she's also remembered for the decorative collar she wore along with her black robes. While the men in the court wore traditional suits and ties, she made statements with various beautiful and decorative collars that expressed her story and her passions. Eleanor Carucci was commissioned to photograph Ginsburg's collection of collars soon after the justice's death. She did so under some really tight time constraints in the actual Supreme Court building where Ginsburg worked. Eleanor is famous for her intimate and vulnerable photographs of herself and her family, which explore themes of femininity, motherhood, and aging. Despite not possessing a pedigree in still life photography, she brought a sensitivity to her photographs that honored the memory of one of America's exceptional human beings. This is Ibarian X, and welcome back to The Candid Frame. Well, it was a pleasant surprise to hear from you, I have to say. I'd reached out.
I know. I was because it's been a while.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just like, well, she's contacting me. That's wonderful. Because
I'm glad we're doing
it. Yeah, I've long loved your work, and I've been eager to sit down and talk with you. And it's fascinating that it's this book that's bringing us together. Since it's such a departure from what everyone, probably including you, are very used to.
I love Chris, and him and I are we think in some ways in a similar way. We're both very straightforward, and I don't know, we just bonded.
It was funny reading your essay in the beginning of the book where, you know, on the passing of Justice Ginsburg, you were thinking of something that would, in the spirit of her career and her legacy and what she contributed, and then you get that call. That must have been the strangest feeling to find yourself being asked. Fair.
It's still strange, to be honest, because I feel, you know, it's really, I wouldn't be the default photographer for this assignment for many photo editors. And I think it was maybe the only assignment I got because of more of who I am, and not necessarily because of my work, because I'm not a still life photographer. I'm not a fashion photographer. And even Catherine Pomeranz was like, Eleanor, I have this assignment, before she told me, and she said it's a still life assignment. And I was like, so why is she calling me? But then she started to explain, and I was like so ecstatic. And maybe you read that I told her I photographed my own uterus trying to earn her trust. and then I hung up the phone and I was like, I wonder why she gave it to me. And I think it was she wanted a woman, maybe an immigrant, maybe a Jewish woman. I don't know, feminist. I don't know what it was. But I was like, I'm not going to let her down. I'm going to photograph the still life just like I would a person, in a way.
That's exactly the point I wanted to discuss with you. But before we get to that, you know, I was thinking about that very same question about considering your body of work, you know, why you would be selected for that. And I've observed photographers being selected to do an assignment or a project that most people would never consider. And most photographers who see it will go, well, we'll look at their pedigree in terms of technique, right? In terms of what the right. what they've done.
Right.
And I think for the great majority of it, it seems to me that the director, the art director, the editor has chosen those people not because of their technical expertise, but because of their sensitivity. And even though it may not have been explained to you why you got it, I suspect that was a big factor in you being chosen. What do you think?
I hope so. I take what you're saying as a compliment, but I also know that it takes vision out of the photo editor, because many photo editors will be more safe.
Yeah.
You know, they will see something in our portfolio and they will be, oh, she can photograph accessories, which I don't have in my portfolio. So it's exactly what you're saying, but not all photo editors. I always tell my students, I'm like, if you want to be hired for something, make sure it's in your portfolio or on your website. Because otherwise, don't expect the photo editors are busy. There are too many of us photographers out there, have a million photographers, and they will not think, how will this person bring their sensitivity, as you're saying. Some do. I give them credit, and Catherine did, but many times we have to fight so our sensitivities or our vision will put to the mission. We have to prove it in order to earn it. But I proved it, I guess, in a different way, hopefully.
Yeah, and I think that such opportunities come out of relationships that have developed trust. That's not going to happen for someone who's just starting out. But because you guys had worked together and had a sense of each other, and I think that's a big factor on such opportunities coming to a photographer. Yeah, there are sometimes a photographer themselves has to be their own cheerleader and fight to make it happen. But there's something to be said about long-standing relationships in the world of in the world of editorial.
Right. Or in the world.
Yeah. You know, very true.
Relationship, trust, from our marriage to our parenthood, to work, to teaching, everything. Everything is trust.
I've had a couple of times where I've said yes to something, you know, and as soon as I hang up or I've sent the email, I go, oh, crap, now I got to actually do it.
I know. I have sometimes assignments where I'm praying they will get canceled or something, because I get so stressed out that I'm like, oh, I hope that the plane will crash. I mean, sometimes I'm really stressed out because someone put their, just what you said, trust. Mm-hmm. Someone put their trust in me. It's a compliment, but then it's you have to prove, you have to, you know, make sure that they feel trusting us was the right decision. Yeah.
How do you prepare for this? Because I was really surprised when they said you had about like 7 minutes with each caller.
Six minutes.
Since you weren't going to be able to handle them before, and they were all made from different materials, and they were different issues of color and fabric and reflection, all those things. How do you prepare to shoot a variety of different things in 6 minutes without really having a sense of how they're going to respond to light, to the camera?
I know. I did. So what I did is I took paper towel, Bounty paper towel, and I, with scissors, I made a shape of her most famous South African collar. On the Catherine had the prop designer send me the board. We decided to photograph it on black velvet. And I put the lights as I'm going to put them in the, so I put lights that are not going to be too harsh, so it's diffused enough on one side, and on the other side, it's Beauty Edition Grid to give it a more of a pop. And I tested, and I sent her the tests. But I also knew that, you know, when I'm there, I'm going to have to kind of do a little bit of tweaks, but I just photographed this paper towel as a color. I sent it to Catherine, and I was like, this is the light, and we prepared the light, and I was ready with the light, and I knew that I will just have to, once I get them, just shoot. And as you saw in the book, there are also the close-ups of them. Right, yeah. So I get closer, change lens. I had to be really quick. But as a mom who's been photographing my kids since they were born, as babies, toddlers, and in the last few years as teenagers, that sometimes give me 10 seconds, I became very fast. I'm very fast.
I do work along these lines. I work for the Huntington Museum and Library in the Pasadena area. And so I photograph a variety of different materials. And one of the things that makes it interesting is that you'll get an object and that's not been photographed before, and you have to sort of figure it out. Like one of the things that came in this week, and I didn't photograph it, one of the other photographers photographed, were these seeds. Because they have a garden there, and they had a botanist there that needed to see these seeds photographed. And we were looking at these things, go, okay, how do we photograph these things? What kind of light do we use? What's the, you know, do you use direct light? Do we use diffusion? Do we use raking light? All those sort of things, which make it fun and interesting. But again, I got more than 6 minutes. So once you have those items in front of you, there's no doubt that at some point you realize that there's something that you have to sort of figure out. So was the majority of the things that you had to determine was it light and how to say maybe modify it or control contrast? Exactly what were some of the problems that you had to solve in order to get those photographs within that time constraint?
So one major problem was that I started to cry with one of the colors because it was a month after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. Mm. And my daughter was very emotional about it. And then it was this the family color with the words of her husband. It's not sacrifice, it's family. I started to cry, and my husband was like, stop crying. You're wasting the time. We have 4 minutes left. Fortunately, and I have the colors here in front of me, most of them were not, how do you say it in English, like a glass, not too reflective. Okay. So that, because that is the worst. They were, most of them made out of fabric or lace. They had some beads, but they were not very reflective. So there was one, the Santa Fe color that was reflective. And it was not easy. I did eliminate some little things later in post with this one because I didn't have the time to start bringing a whole other set of lights. But most of them were not reflective. So it was not like something that I couldn't get over. So we had to maybe tweak the light according to how dark or light they were, but nothing that would require a completely different set of light.
And you were set up in some sort of conference or meeting room. You weren't in a photo studio of any sort. You just had to create this space in at the Supreme Court.
Right. And it was, I mean, I'm an immigrant. My husband was with me. We're both immigrants from Israel. So just to be in the Supreme Court, we were just, oh my God, thank God we're already citizens. It was a very beautiful room, you know. But there was no other. I mean, sometimes I'm thinking maybe I should have come with more gear and more assistance. I came with my husband. I came with the same gear that I'm photographing my other work, midlife and mother and closer, that I'm photographing my kids and myself and my husband and portraits. And not, you know, I really didn't photograph it, whether it's good enough as a still life photographer, you know, with all the boards and the cards that people are putting. And I did photograph it similarly to how I would a person's face. So maybe I got a little lucky, and the way that there weren't like major problems that came up.
Yeah, it's
that would require a real still life photographer in the room.
Yeah, because some of those things can be incredibly, incredibly tricky. Yeah,
I know. Even when I'm photographing people and they're wearing glasses, it can be, you know, hell. So I was, when I was looking at what Catherine sent me, I saw that I don't have like glass there or things that are too reflective. And I was like, it's mostly cloth or fabrics or lace. And I can deal with it.
You said earlier that you photographed these objects, these colors, as if they were portraits. So.
Right.
Spell out to me and spell out to us what that means to you in terms of not so much technically what you're doing, but in terms of mindset, what's happening, you know, for you to approach it in that way?
I think mainly the mindset was frustration. I was like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died and now I'm getting this assignment. But what I really wish is that I could photograph her. And her children, and her grandchildren, and her husband was no longer alive for some years. So I think it was more an emotional, it wasn't a conceptual, it wasn't like, you know, let me think how I'm going to approach it and why. It was more like, I wish she was there. I wish I could really photograph a piece of her life. I wish I could listen to her talk and tell her how much I admire her. So in a way, it was like, but this is what we have left. And I wish to find her or little, you know, little hints to her personality or even little things like the clasp with the rust on it or the fabric falling apart or little threads coming out or just things that will be more intimate, more personal, more revealing. And together with the stories that we heard, tell us a little bit about, you know, and over there at the Supreme Court, I overheard them because the writer was talking to one of the clerks who worked with Justice Ginsburg, and each of them, and then later when we did the book, Sarah Bader, you know, dug deeper into each story. And just being there in the Supreme Court and listening to them, talking about her, it was all together feeling like I have a little bit of a path to who she was.
Yeah. I love the discovery of the importance of these collars. Because I've certainly seen those group portraits countless number of times, but I never thought of what's called the jabot. Is that how it's said?
Jabot.
Right, which is the, you know, the neck garnishment that they wear in complement to the black robes. The guys are in their suits and ties, but the women of the court would have these wonderful flourishes, and it was not just decorative, it was declarative of who they were as women. And their presence on a court that had long been dominated by men. And that context made the significance of each one made me realize the importance of them, and the variety of them made me appreciate the variety so much more, because each one was so distinctive, as if she was expressing something about herself, her opinions, her thoughts, her feelings, when she wore these things. So it must have been sort of remarkable for you to see these and get that sense.
I know. It was first of all, it was interesting to discover that the collection kind of took a life of its own, because some of them were commissioned by friends or the law clerks who worked with her. a lot by the law clerks or Columbia Law School. Some were sent to her by fans who either made them for her or bought them in a vintage store. It was also interesting to see, you know, I mainly knew, I never paid too much attention to the colors. I knew, of course, and paid a lot of attention to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but I mainly knew the South African, the famous one on the cover of the book. But it was interesting, you know, when we're thinking about famous, important people, I thought I'm going to come and find expensive necklaces and famous designers, and it was very much a collection of the people. They're like collars that are vintage, that are collars that lace maker, female lace maker did for her. There is one of Banana Republic. There is one of Anthropology. All of those collars, you and I can get something like this. Some of them, my grandma might have, when she did crochet, this is like things that she did. So it was, yet they were beautiful and special and represented different cultures. And that was really who Ruth Bader Ginsburg was to me. There was something humble. She was a hard worker. She was a daughter of immigrants. And there was something really beautiful about it. It wasn't some celebrity collection, you know. So that was something that I discovered that was just beautiful, inspiring.
It's really fascinating when these inanimate objects take on a life of their own. Oftentimes it's associated with members in our own family. Right. There may have been a certain pair of shoes or slippers or a pipe. And when that person is gone, that object takes on a resonance within all the people that knew them. Ginsburg was known all over the world. Most people didn't know her personally, but they had a sense of who she was and how her life and her work, you know, changed many lives. So those collars have that emotional resonance, even though you may not have had the pleasure of her presence. And the challenge becomes, how do you honor and convey that in a photograph? I know you only have 6 minutes, but there's also sort of like, another sort of angst about getting it right, just because it's really important. Not just to you, but
it's true, but I didn't think about all of that too much because there was a sense of, for me, a little bit of urgency. And I also never thought that this could be, you know, I've been shooting for magazines for 25 years and most of my assignments, and some were really meaningful, some were covers and big stories, but the assignments were out, maybe other than maybe one or two, and then that's it. So I never thought that this is going to be my fifth book and a museum show and a gallery show and print. And so it's a little bit like my other work, my personal work. Many times there is a little moment and I take a picture and I'm just in the moment and then it goes out to the world. Sometimes it doesn't have a life there, out there in the world. It's not loved. People don't feel it. People don't resonate with it, don't identify with it. And sometimes they do. And this project really took the spiritual part in me feels it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg blessing to women trying to make a living out there. But I never thought it would become what it is. I mean, not that I didn't push for it. I mean, I decided, okay, I'm going to make a book out of it, but it was a result of people got so emotional. People loved the colors, what they represented and the stories behind them. And they wanted to have, like, they started asking me, can I have a book? Do you have a book? And I was like, no, there isn't a book. And the 10th person that asked me or DM'd me, I was like, I'm thinking about making a book now. A question. So I all of what we're talking right now, it's 3 years after the assignment, after I wrote about it and did a book. And I didn't think about so much of it then. I was just like, oh my God, I'm so moved by it. I'm so touched by it. I'm so honored to be here. And I'm also stressed out because, you know, I didn't have time to think artistically. I was like, oh my God, I better get it right.
But there's something to be said with working with those kinds of limitations. Having the complete freedom of time and money can sometimes be an onerous obstacle to have to contend with in order to be creative.
Very true. I think that some of what makes those images beautiful is the simplicity. Mm-hmm. They're photographed on a black background, a black velvet. It's just the colors. I'm not trying to bring in something that isn't there. What's there are the colors and the stories and, you know, what we know of her. So maybe if I had a month to spend with them, just like you said, I would feel that I have to bring my vision and get creative and put them. I had a friend who said, maybe you'll put them on a mannequin, ask them. And I was like, there isn't time to do it. And as you said, it was in a way blessing because it was, this is what I have here. This is this color that she wore. And everything is about the story behind it. And I have 6 minutes to photograph the beauty of it. And that's it. Like, quickly move on. And there was some blessing in it.
You know, when I look at you, you know, your body of work, which is largely revolves around self-portraiture, photographs of your family, your mother, your kids, your husband. And a lot of those images are about the human presence in the photograph. And I was looking at these pictures. And like I said before, objects can take on personality. And I was curious to know whether you have photographed objects within your life, within that space, but that never ended up finding its way into the edit, and whether or not this assignment has influenced the way that you do shoot your standard work.
So I did photograph objects, but in a very different way. I mean, I photographed, first of all, it's not objects, but I photographed a lot of details. There are details of eyes and hands and lips and kisses that are kind of functioning like a little bit like still lifes or like a representation for something that is more universal than my grandmother and what I know of her. But I also photographed food and the dishes my grandma and mom cooked and their makeup and some of their jewelry. I photographed their jewelry on them. It's something I really realize in retrospect. But it was always in the context of people. But as you're saying, it was photographing my grandmother's ring or my mother's necklace or my mother's nail and putting the nail polish on it. And funny enough, even though this body of work is really successful, I didn't change. I still want to photograph people. I still get the same assignments that I feel are like the sensitive photographer, quote unquote, assignments, photographing people who've been through maybe something more challenging or lost someone or dealing with disease or with some kind of more intimate things that life brings us all. So it's not like I now want to photograph collection of important, inspiring people. I want to photograph people. Yeah. It's just, I have been since I was 15 and I still am.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, having focused on these collars, that it kind of revealed new subject matter in your familiar space that up until that moment you weren't seeing, if that makes any sense.
Right.
You know, you have something that happens and all of a sudden something that's been in front of you forever is suddenly revealed to you, and you see it as if for the first time.
I think what it made me feel even stronger is that everything passes, and I better photograph more of my children and more of the people I love and more of other people and more stories. Because again, I feel like, and I'm grateful for this assignment, but I still wish I could photograph a day in the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg with her family. This is just who I am, and this assignment I think is a once in a lifetime thing for me.
You know, you're.
But who knows? We never know. I'm 52. I got a few more years to, or decades.
Yes.
A few more decades.
Don't rush it.
No rushing. I wanna work till the day I die.
Yeah, I tell my friends. Yeah, I want to walk into the box with a mic in one hand and a camera in the other.
I am too. We love what we do, so we're lucky in that way.
I wonder how. I don't know much about Israeli culture. When I see your work, in the culture that my family from is, which is Dominican, that kind of intimacy and vulnerability, openly displayed is not common. You know, there's a phrase I remember that I heard repeatedly in my family: "No se hable de eso." We don't speak of this, right? It was always about, there were certain things that were kept quiet and underneath the shadows. And I was curious how your upbringing, your culture may have sort of informed your ability to be as open and vulnerable in your work.
Definitely, I'm a result of my culture. I mean, I'm coming from a Mizrahi background. In Israel, so there are the Jews that came from Europe and Eastern Europe. That there are the Jews that came from the Arab countries and the Middle East. So my family is from Morocco, North Africa, Bukhara. It's an area in Uzbekistan, and Spain a little bit, and Syria. So the Mizrahi Jews are the more warm and open. But all Israelis are very straightforward. Sometimes we even think of this identity of the Sabra, the Israeli, that was created as a contrast to the Jew in Europe that got slaughtered in the Holocaust. The weak, kind of maybe too gentle Jew. They created the Sabra, the Israeli, that is very straightforward. We say everything as it is, very open, sometimes too straightforward. So people would see it even as rudeness. The Israeli culture can be rude. It can be, you know, manners, and it's not our strong side. I was always a gentle person, but I grew up in a very open house. This is not at all like what you describe about your family. We talked about everything all the time. I saw my parents naked. They saw me naked. I saw all the women in my family naked around me. And that was not, it was maybe more unusual that I saw my father naked, but all of my friends in Israel, my female friends, saw their grandmom and moms and aunts in nudity, talking about everything, making fun of our mustaches or our little flaws of our bodies. So in that way, many people ask me, how do your parents accept or agree? I am the result of the way they raised me. And everything, it was a very open, very intimate, very loving way. And Israel overall is very, it was hard for me to come to America and to understand. Like even the way I was being turned down when I was showing my work, the first few years. Now I understand. Now I am like, I became paranoid because I don't even know, even when people like my work, I'm like, what do they really think? Because I don't know. Because in Israel, if I'm showing my work and people don't want to give me an exhibition, it can be like, oh my God, you have no talent. This is garbage. You have no filter. Take it out of here. But here, you know, the first few meetings, people are like, you know, American culture. They're like, this is very interesting work. This is maybe not for our next show, but definitely keep us in touch. This is a way to say no. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it. I was like, they want to keep my work. They want me to keep in touch. I'll probably be the next show. It took me a while to understand the different ways of saying things. Americans are, you have honest and dishonest American, honest and dishonest Israelis, but there are different cultures, there are different ways to say something, different like manners. And
it's often said that everybody thinks they're a photographer these days. All you need is a smartphone and an Instagram account. And if you are on any of those apps, you know the countless images you have to swipe through in order to find something that speaks to you. And even if you do, you only linger on it for a few seconds, and then you're on to the next one. You know, it's sad to think that after all the time, money, and effort made into making those photographs, the final experience goes by so quickly. Now, I love lingering on photographs, savoring them. I certainly learn from them, but I also greatly enjoy them, especially in the form of a book. There are few things as wonderful as sitting in my chair in my office on a rainy day, opening the pages of a new book, and going on a journey. That's a great day. And you can experience the same thing each month with your membership to the Charcoal Book Club. With your membership, you receive a quality monograph each month. The books reflect the diversity of genres, photographers, and styles that you'll enjoy even if they are not a genre of photography you practice yourself. And if you don't like that month's release, you can choose an alternative book of equal value in their catalog. They offer free shipping to the US, Canada, and the UK. It's subsidized elsewhere. Sign up today and use the promo code TheCandidFrame at checkout to enjoy 10% off your first membership payment. And thanks to the many of you who have supported The Candid Frame over the years, your contributions go a long way to helping us do the work that we do here. Now, I know you probably think that somebody else is doing it, so you don't have to. But the reality is, of the tens of thousands of people who have listened to the show, only a handful have taken the step to support it. So if that's you, you could change all that today, and it would make a big difference. You can become a part of it by becoming a Patreon supporter today. You can contribute $5, $10, $20 or more a month by visiting patreon.com/thecandidframe. Again, it's patreon.com/thecandidframe. And now, if you only want to make a one-time donation, you can do that by going to buymeacoffee.com/thecandidframe. Considering that you found what, not some, I don't want to say style, but you found an approach and a sensibility by the time you had arrived here, and the temptation might be that in order to make a career, you have to change that, right? And especially when people are seeing imagery that is so intimate and vulnerable, that creates a discomfort in them, that you know, not have to sort of question, do I continue doing it this way, or do I need to adapt and sort of rein that in order to accommodate, you know, the sensibilities, the biases, the preferences of the people that I'm trying to work with?
I think some of it was also, in a way, insecurity. I've been playing classical piano. So even though I come from a Middle Eastern culture, my mom, who never went to college, my dad is a taxi driver, never went to college. She raised me in a very Western culture, very strict kind of Jewish tiger mom kind of thing. And I played classical piano for 13 years, and I studied acting, and went to school. So I know what it is, especially in the arts, to be mediocre. And when I discovered photography, immediately there was something very strong that happened. And then I developed my, you don't want to call it style, but the way that I shoot. And I knew that there was something special there. And so I wouldn't dare to let it go because I felt this is finally, finally something I can do well. I can photograph intimacy. Later on, I realized I can also do it with strangers. I can photograph intimacy. I'm not, this is what I can do. It's not like it's a choice. It's not like maybe if there is something else or fashion or, I wouldn't be a good fashion photographer, I think. So some of it was like, this is me. This is the only thing I can bring. There is nothing else. So I better fight for it.
So what was it about who you were and how you approached photography that allowed you to also do it with strangers? You know, it had nothing to do with the camera or the lens you were using. It had nothing to do with that. But what did you discover about yourself? What was the quality that you possessed that allowed you to, you know, meet someone who you didn't know any, you know, at all, other than what was the information that was given to you by the editor, and create a right. space where you could create those kinds of photographs?
First of all, I don't know if you know this, but I was a professional belly dancer for 12 years.
Yes, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that. And to be a belly dancer, especially in the way that I was here, I started in Jerusalem, but here I danced to many immigrant communities, Israelis sometimes and Arabs that I knew, but other immigrant communities. And different, like I, because I was so specific and particular in my art, I told my agents, I can dance everywhere, in basements. I had a performance in a deli. In New York City. Weddings, anniversaries, rich people, poor people, everything. Mm-hmm. And many times I would be paid okay, and many times I only danced for tips. So I was had to develop a way to open up the people to me, to feel welcome, to feel that I understand who they are. I read the room. I understand when I have to be shy, so they will help me get over my shyness. When I had to slap the guys and the grandmas would get up and dance with me, the different cultures, the different personalities. And it was also my way to knowing America. I mean, I moved to Manhattan. We have the art world. It's very specific kind of people that I sometimes felt like an outsider to. And here I was like an immigrant dancing for many different people. And I didn't feel like I'm so different. I'm just another immigrant, you know, in New York, in America. And it taught me a lot about coming into a room and just taking in, feeling, listening, respecting, but opening up, just being you, being quiet, being you, maybe being loud if it requires to be loud. And I think it really helped me. When I started shooting for magazines and shooting strangers, just the same thing, just to come. There's no formula. Just be me. I'm also different. I have an accent. I'm a woman. This is who I am. And I really, especially when I'm with a camera, I really tend to, my kids make fun of it when I shoot their friends. When I photograph someone, it's not that I'll love them forever and become their best friend forever. But at the moment, it really comes with love, you know, to other people.
Yeah, there's a big difference between being seen and being photographed. And,
Very different.
That's what you're doing, is that you're seeing them. And I think that when people feel that, they feel more comfortable. They let their guard down when they feel like they're just a camera is being pointed at them. It's hard to elicit anything really genuine from them, which is a hard skill to, it's a hard skill to develop. And obviously belly dancing gave that to you, which isn't, going to be a common path, but not to say that there are other ways that people can develop that skill.
Right. People work in different ways. I even remember, you know, that's how I met Chris. He photographed me.
Mm.
He works in a very different way than I do. And in some ways it's difficult. On the other hand, there is some simplicity to it. You have to bring yourself, and that's why it's okay that he photographs differently, and it's okay that different photographers work differently, because if it's genuine and it's who we are and it's how we want to see this person, as long as we want to see them. And I tell some of my students, some are very shy, and I'm like, that's not a problem. Mm-hmm. You're bringing who you are, as long as you're respectful, you're there with good and open intentions, you can stay shy. You don't have to change your personality. I'm not shy. I'm just saying that.
But
I am not shy.
But how are you as a photographic subject?
I'm also very open. I was at art school. If anyone needed a model, I am. First of all, because I photographed my own flaws. I am not so afraid of it. So they will get me in a bad day. People will see that I'm 52, even when I was younger. People will see that my imperfections. I photograph it every day myself. It's liberating. So the imperfections are out there. Who cares? And I like being behind the camera. I like being photographed. I like photographers. I think sometimes when I had, you know, we all have, most of us photographers, bad times in our career where we're thinking about switching and doing something else. And I think sometimes one of the things that kept me in this profession, I was like, but I love photographers. I want to be surrounded by photography and photographers, other photographers. I want to be photographed and photograph other people. So I just the whole action, the whole mystery of photography and the process, I love it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. There are better professions, as both you and I know.
You know, in other interviews, you've mentioned photographers that have been, you know, served as inspirations. But so much of your work to me is very painterly. And I was wondering whether there are painters that you feel like have influenced the way that you see as well.
There are a lot of artists, but I feel I have really been influenced by photography, I have to say, and maybe painterly photography. People like Sally Mann and Emmett Goen that I mentioned. I many times, I don't know if influenced aesthetically because it's different, but influenced by stand-up comedian and how they're...
That's interesting.
How honest they are, how they make us think differently about everyday things, which is, I feel, what I'm trying to do with my work. They just use humor to seduce their audience. And I try to use beauty. That's maybe why you're talking about painterly. I'm trying to use light and colors and compositions to show a life of a woman after hysterectomy, you know, show things that sometimes people don't want to see. People don't necessarily want to look at middle-aged women and what they're going through. And I sometimes think if I'll light it well enough, if it will be a beautiful composition with mystery, with dark, with light, I can bring those truths that stand-up comedians sometimes bring. And I love the work of, you know, many, from Wanda Sachs to Louis C.K. to many people.
Yeah, great art is challenging. It's, at least for me, it is. Right?
It's very challenging.
And, you know, whether it's a stand-up comic or a photographer or a painter, it's the thing that stops me. You know, we flip through things all the time without a second thought. And then every once in a while, you'll experience a piece of work. It could be, you know, music, it could be painting, it could be a joke or photograph. And there's something about it that is just completely arresting. And it's sometimes very hard to quantify what that is. It's like, you know it when you see it or when you hear it, when you touch it. But there is an intrinsic genuineness, which I know is sort of an elusive, nebulous statement to make.
No, but for me too.
That's the only way I can describe it.
It's exactly. It's something that we feel that is just genuine, that is authentic, that is real, that touched us or moved us, or even offended us or challenged us somehow. But we feel it. There is something there.
And like your work.
And it's
and like your work, it's the flaws. You know, it's the imperfections. It's not making the effort to make it perfect. Because I look at so much work that is technically accomplished, but I don't feel anything. And I see work that has some sort of technical issue with it, right? Either purposely or unintentionally, but I still fall in love with it. And
it's funny that you're saying it, because just before I came into the podcast, for a few days now, I've been talking to my husband about AI. And I showed him some photographer who was like working with AI, and we're talking about flaws. It's not flawed. It's all perfect and beautiful and polished. And he told me that's why it's not going to ever replace real photography, artists, documentary photography, war photography. It's not. It's just going to be another illustrative tool. Maybe some people will manage to make art with it, but it's not going to replace. I don't know if he's right or not. We're all talking about AI, but because there are no flaws, it doesn't feel. It's just like, it's beautiful, but it might change, but it doesn't like, it's like something that was too airbrushed or too photoshopped, and we're saying, it lost its beauty.
It's Tupperware.
Oh, you're harsher than me and my husband.
I mean, it's interesting. I played with it, you know, and been amazed at what a bunch of, you know, text prompts can produce. You know, and it's really fascinating. And like anything, like when digital came, you know, everyone that was shooting film said the sky was falling, and it transformed, it changed things. But to say that photography is now dead, I think is a bit presumptive. There'll always be a place for the work that, you know, photographers like you create. And that there'll be a place for that.
You know. So it's another form of art, but it's not one to replace what we do and to replace things that are more real or flawed.
Yeah. And it's complicated because, of course, you know, photographers, other creatives, you know, who have relied on certain kinds of work may find that work is no longer available because there's some, you know, college graduate typing something in the keyboard that satisfies somebody who really doesn't care. He just wants an illustration for the website or for the brochure and doesn't care how it was created. He just wants that space filled. And that's fine for that, but that doesn't mean, you know, it's like when the stock photography went away, which is a big way that a lot of photographers earned a living through the 70s and the 80s. I mean, it was lucrative for a lot of photographers. That was the bulk of their income. And then when that went away, it's like photographers had to adapt, and they had to find other ways of being able to sort of make a living. And some people got out of the business and other people adapted. And, you know, whining and complaining about it is one thing. It's making a decision. Well, what are you going to do about it? Because it's not going to stop.
It forces us to change and evolve, and we don't want to change. I think there is something in us, human beings, most of us, we don't like change. We want things to feel safe, and that we know the world and we know how to make a living and can. I sometimes, as much as I like, I don't like to be challenged. I like the results of being challenged. I always feel like, can I just do that? Wow. I don't want to do anything else. But then I'm forced to shoot for magazines because I have to make a living. And then magazines change. And then digital comes. And then this changed. And then magazine closed. And I have to do, And I always complain about it. I'm like, no, can something stay the same? But then the result of the change and the result of, you know, challenging myself and not giving up and learning something else and changing the way that I work, I'm proud of them. But when it happens, I'm like, no, no, please, everything stay the same. It was good.
I'm taking a class in another art. I'm not going to say what it is, but it's something I have no experience in. And I'm surrounded by people who are really good at it. And oh my God, is it uncomfortable? You know, because in my orbit, I'm competent at what I do. I'm good at it. I know that I'm, you know, at this thing. Oh my God. And every week I go and I have to, you know, do the thing. So much self-doubt, so much insecurity, you know, so much browbeating. But I'm so glad I'm doing it because, like you said, it's uncomfortable as hell. But I needed the challenge, and I knew that it had to be outside of photography in order for that to happen, because I was too reliant on the things that I did well that I could never get completely uncomfortable. And I don't know how that's going to influence my photography, but that was sort of the idea that embracing that discomfort will likely help me in terms of what I end up doing with the camera.
Everything we do help. Every, you know, if it's another art form, if it's working on a book, if it's becoming a parent, everything we're getting, you know, more and more as we get older, we do get. That's why I do feel that there's some wisdom and blessing that comes with age, because I see it in my work and I see it in my teaching. We know more, we feel more, we had more pains and challenges, and that's how we grow. Even if we don't want to, and many times I don't want to grow. I don't want to like mature. I just want to, but that's the beauty and the terrible side of life. It's beautiful and it's terrible.
But I have no doubt, at least from my experience, that teaching is a way of getting comfortable with that, right? Because you have to go there in order to be able to elicit that from the people that you're trying to inspire and encourage to do something, especially when it comes to something like photography, you know, because people who are studying with you see something in your work that they aspire to, but they're not going to get there from learning shutter speed and aperture, right?
And I don't also know how they're going to get there, because it's many times very different than how I work and how I get to my, and, you know, even with my work, when I wanted to start photographing the teenage years of my kids, I had to change the way I worked. Even when I moved to America, the light here is so different. Everything's different. I had to change. And to keep myself doing good work, which I don't always do, I do it in a certain way. But then teaching, every one of us is very different. So that's also challenging for me, because I can tell the student, this is what I did. Do the same. It's not going to work. So we have to find with each person their journey, how they're getting to do the work, how they're getting what they want to say, how they want to say it. And this is challenging, because just like with shooting people for magazines, there is no formula. Yeah. That's what's so hard about being an artist and about teaching art and learning art. There is no formula. It's not like I can tell them. There is a formula for the technical side, as I said, but it's not about the aperture and the light and studying. It's a lot about that too. We have to know our craft, but it's this mysterious thing that every one of us have to find in ourselves.
You just said something very interesting, that sometimes you don't produce good work. What's good work?
All the time.
What does that mean to you? I know what it means for me. What does it mean for you?
What is good work? I think good work is getting deep enough into something that I find something universal there. And good work for me is about being human. If I can produce an image that goes to the depth of what it is to be human, it can be different parts of being human. Mm-hmm. It can be love or connection or anger or jealousy or pain or aging or youth. And in this moment, I went deep to find something, but this something is also somehow touches other people. This is good work. And sometimes I don't know, like I look at the work and I'm like, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And after a few days, I'm like, there's something here. I don't know why. Later, I'll sit down to write about a book. It can be 7 years later. And I will understand.
Maybe it sounds to me is that you make the work and make the discovery as a result of making a lot of work, and then you go through it, and then it's revealed to you. It may not be obvious in the moment that you're making the photographs, but as you go right. And you call for the images, all of a sudden you see it.
That's why it's so humbling to be a photographer, because many times I'll look at a photo shoot of my daughter. I did one a few days ago, a few weeks ago already, and there was an image I took to test the light, and I'm like, okay, this is the good image. Like, it's ridiculous. It's like sometimes when we let the guard off, or when we're... But even those accidents, I own them, because it's like dreams. The accidents or the things that are happening when we take pictures are like our dreams. They're coming out of us. So the good and the bad work, and the good work can't exist without right. The bad work.
We need to
take those bad and mediocre images and work through them and hate them and be frustrated and say, I'm trying to photograph this and this, or what my kids are feeling at the moment of being a teenager. It's not there. And I get so angry that eventually I make the good picture.
Just
out of anger.
I just took a workshop with Sam Abel, famous National Geographic photographer. I've known him for about 10 years, and I finally said, I need to sit down at his feet for a while. And he said something really interesting that I kind of knew, but he sort of crystallized when he said it. And he said, basically the zone he tries to be in is in the zone of being able to make a good photograph, right? That he knows if he's in that space long enough, that every once in a while, a great photograph will result. And that all he has to do is be in that space where he knows he can make a good photograph, rather than trying to make a great one every time. And I was like, yep, that's it.
Right. And also sometimes the bad photographs, we see something there that didn't work out. But this is something to pay attention to. I mean, the light broke, it's all dark. I'm like, maybe I should take dark images, you know, when most of the motive is not lit. So it's good to let ourselves, you know, if we only try to make good pictures, we won't do it anyway, and we won't grow, and we won't learn, and we have to experiment, we have to change the way we're shooting, we have to try other things and not be good at them, and then maybe improve. But even if we don't improve, we'll go back to what we know different. So
it's interesting that in terms of the way that you work, you are documenting your own life, but sometimes there's a degree of control and sometimes recreation of a moment in order to get that. And that could be very sort of exacting and very controlling. But what sometimes really makes the work happen is a moment of serendipity, of chance, of the unexpected. And what gets you into that space where you can not hold so tight a grip on the reins, right? Where you can welcome that in, because if you're too controlled, you get exactly what you intended to, but that may not be it. So how do you sort of loosen things up to be able to be open to that?
I feel it's just a constant search. I mean, I always use lights. I use strobes or LED lights, and I have something in mind, but I know that I have to keep looking and looking and looking and let things happen and let people move and let people feel and let people step out of the light and come back to it. It's a lot of just knowing how much we don't know, and we have to keep open and take pictures and see, always see everything that's happening. If someone is sometimes telling you, oh, hold on a minute, when you're taking a picture, I'm not ready. Sometimes this is the moment. And so always pay attention to everything, because everything is interesting.
Well, my last question that I ask each guest is I ask them to recommend another photographer for our listeners to discover and explore, and it can be anyone, someone you've long admired or someone you've recently discovered. So who would that one photographer be and why?
Well, in the light of what is happening with the war in Israel now between Israel and Hamas, the work that Ziv Koren did, he's an Israeli photographer. He's usually not so much of a war photographer, more in the last few years. And on October 7th, he went there to the kibbutzim around Gaza and took pictures. And he has been taking pictures since that day in Gaza and of the families of the hostages. He has many bodies of work that are wonderful, but this work is very, very special. And it's happening today, like every day he is adding to the work. And he has really arresting images of October 7. And there is something about war photography, maybe because I'm not in this world. A fine art photographer, people would call, but there is something about war photography. It is what it is. There is no lights there. It's no studio. There is no models. It's just human beings in their worst and in their best. So I admire war photographers.
Well, thank you so much for your time and generosity and for reaching out. I'm so happy to have finally had a chance to talk with you. Yeah,
hold on a second. Thank you so much, Ivaronex. Thank you. And thank you for, you know, getting back to me when I finally got back to you. I'm glad it worked out. And thank you for looking at the work, the new work, and the book, and the colors, and all of that, for your attention to my work.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm really grateful.
Thanks to Eleanor for joining us. Learn more about Eleanor and her work by visiting eleanorcurici.com. And if you're a fan of our work, you can write reviews on whatever service you use to listen to podcasts and share a favorite episode on social networks, be it X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Remember to use the hashtag TheCandidFrame. You can support us financially via Patreon. And if you want to make a one-time donation to the show, you can do so by visiting buymeacoffee.com/TheCandidFrame. Thanks to Zave Smith, Barbara Peacock, and Deborah Espinosa for their recent contributions. We've also relaunched our newsletter. If you want to receive updates on everything related to TCF, please visit our website and sign up. And if you can't find every episode of the show on whatever service you use to listen to podcasts, download the Candid Frame app, available for Apple iOS and Android. And because of your generosity, it's free to download and use. No additional purchases are required. The Candid Frame's audio engineer is Martin Taylor, who you can find at theothermartintaylor.com. The show's senior producer is Cynthia Parker. And this is Ibarian X, and this is The Candid Frame.